Before we start on our papers for today, which are on Ptolemaic Egypt and Bedouin, at least, and maybe some Russian as well, two general points that I wanted to make. One of them is, please remember that this is a course on legal systems, and therefore, although I'm happy to be told lots of other things about a society, there ought to be sort of a core of your paper that's explaining something about his legal system. The other is that you ought to think about taking advantage of the virtues of the Internet. That one of the things that's changed is that everybody is now next door to everybody. So if you are looking for information on some obscure topic, there is almost certainly someone in the world who's an expert on that topic. And with a little help from your friend Google, you might be able to find him. Maybe more than one person. But if you look for a professor of such and such, I was discussing this with the author of the paper we're going to have on early Russian stuff, and I bet that with a little effort you could find someone at Harvard or Stanford or somewhere else, maybe even outside of the U.S., who is an expert on medieval Russian stuff. And if you're an expert on medieval Russian stuff, and everybody else thinks that's a pretty weird thing to be an expert on, and you get an email out of the blue from a stranger who's a student at Santa Clara saying, could you please help me? I'm writing a paper on this really interesting stuff, and I thought you might be able to answer some questions. The odds are not bad that you'll answer it, that you'll feel sort of flattered, and, you know, somebody else is interested in what you're interested in. So take advantage of that, all right? At some point in your revising, see if you can find someone in the world who knows much more than you do about this subject. And ask him if you mind, you know, email the person if you get an answer. Do you mind if I ask you some questions? Can you point me at sources? Would you even be willing to look at my paper and tell me what I've got wrong, what I've been trying to do with the chapters for my book, with the appropriate experts and so forth? So just don't be shy. People don't mind being asked questions, generally. All right, those are the main pieces of advice. Let me now turn it over to our Ptolemaic expert. If anybody is interested in the beginning of that system, there is a very good three-volume historical novel, which is on Alexander the Great, of which the third volume starts at his death. It's called Funeral Games, and it's largely about the founder of the Ptolemaic system, who was or was not a half-brother of Alexander's.
Expert's a bit of a stretch. One of the problems is that I don't have a whole lot to talk about. This is not on paper. Pretty much everything.
That's fine.
Everything I know, you know. One thing that I didn't want to bring up was that the last line of the paper might have, you know, given you a false sense of the bureaucracy's benevolence. And it's true that they tried to faithfully execute the laws, or so it seems to me. But I also have read a couple of rather melodramatic but very entertaining accounts of Ptolemaic tax studies. And I couldn't really find a place to put them in my paper because I didn't end up talking about taxation as much as I wanted to because I just didn't have enough space. I've gone by my own, you know. How long should they be, though, do you think?
I expect your hard drive will probably hold a book if you really insist on writing it. But that seems a little extreme.
Yeah, and from the rest of the paper, you know, you can probably predict what will happen because, you know, repeatedly emphasized, Ptolemies are really serious about their revenue, so when it comes time to pay taxes, the levy is basically a couple of tax collectors and several soldiers and such going into a town and basically beating and torturing and, you know, running down people who haven't paid their taxes and, you know, basically just, you know, hurting them until they do pay. So, you know, despite a relatively high level of sophistication, it's still a fairly brutal system, you know, although certainly effective. Also, one thing that you didn't get to talk about were the actual amounts of Ptolemaic revenue, and there's some ambiguity there because a lot of authors distinguish between royal revenue and state revenue, like the amount of money that goes to the king is about the amount of money that goes to the government. I never really understood that distinction, but from what I can tell, Ptolemaic revenues, state and royal combined, were fairly massive. And that's partially because, you know, Egypt is so fertile, but also because the Ptolemies put a lot of effort into reforming the economy, and again, I didn't get to talk about that as much as I wanted to either, but basically, the Ptolemies switched, well, they started the process which would be later mostly finished by the Romans, of switching taxation in Egypt from in kind, you know, goods and services. You know, you have just agricultural produce or like, you know, corvée labor, to cash in, you know, the form of coinage. So and the, you know, creating a coinage out of sort of from scratch is a huge effort, and the Ptolemies certainly put a lot of effort into it and definitely improved their accounting. And also, it led to the rise of a banking sector, which also helped them to raise a lot more money through, you know, interest and such, and also helped them to secure loans when they couldn't cover their own costs. And that sort of brings me to the sort of the really big point of Ptolemaic Egypt in general that wasn't in my paper, because it's not. I mean, its consequences are relevant, but it itself is not so important. And that's that the Ptolemies, along with the other successors of Alexander, never really stopped thinking of themselves as Alexander. So they always thought they were entitled to the whole thing, from, you know, from what's today like, you know, Hungary or so, all the way out to, you know, all the way out to about Italy or so. And there was a, you got a little bit of that because, you know, I talked about how the first Ptolemy was mostly concerned with the civil war, but, you know, but the Ptolemies constantly warred with their neighbors, especially the Seleucids. That's also in there, and but as well as they also controlled a lot of little islands off the coast of Asia Minor and in the Aegean. So they were in conflict with a lot of the city states in that area, and the Ionian and Greek city states. So they, you know, had a lot of. I mean, they felt like, you know, they were like, you know, heirs of a mighty legacy, you know, they like to say. I mean, not those exact words, but that's a, sort of a paraphrase. And they felt like, you know, it was, you know, even if it wasn't super profitable, you know, that it was their right, and you know, it was important to them that they, you know, pursue that right. You know, of course, there's a somewhat similar concept in our law. You know, this is someone who sleeps on his rights loses them. You know, so if you're not actively prosecuting your claims to X, Y, or Z, you know, people are going to forget about them and you're going to lose your claim. And then I also want to talk about a couple of things in my paper that I think are the most important, and, you know, I put those at the beginning and the end to make it easier, and that's contract law, which I won't talk about too much because it's pretty clear in there how contract law was sort of a microcosm of all of Ptolemaic law, but I didn't get a chance to develop the, well, I haven't yet, I will for the final, but I haven't, in paper you guys have read, developed the final couple of cases as well as I would have liked. And that's, and I really like those cases because, I like the last one because it's got lawyers and that's always fun. But I also like it because it shows just the extent to which, you know, by around the year 100 or so BC, the you know, how far the Ptolemies had come. You know, and you saw in contract law how initially, you know, in pretty much everything, you know, local forms prevailed, and how, you know, and Ptolemy the first was concerned with the civil war, so, you know, nothing really changed, and how the influence of the Ptolemies went from more or less nil at the beginning to, you know, really, really extensive at the end with especially in the Chromaticidae courts, the royal courts, and I mean, in many ways that's the most important court, and I didn't get to make this point as thoroughly as I would have liked yet, but that's that the Chromaticidae courts sort of swallowed the other courts. I mentioned that, but I didn't develop on it too much, and that's just because, again, the bureaucrats were never really effectively controlled by the central government. They were sort of free to do whatever they wanted, and the one thing they did was acquire more and more power for themselves. And so eventually, you know, the various courts became, you know, by hook or by crook, irrelevant. Because on the one hand, you had the Heraeus case, where instead of going to trial, he went straight to adjudication with a bureaucrat. And then in the Hermias case, and the similar names I know, you had a dispute between a Greek and an Egyptian being heard, you know, at first without, you know, going through any of the courts, the Chromaticidae courts, and I thought that was interesting because, you know, it showed that, I think it really showed that that the other courts have become more or less irrelevant. They continue to exist because, you know, the Greek and Egyptian systems remain distinct, you know. But even the, you know, I don't know about the Greek courts, but I do know that, and this is mentioned in the paper as well, that the Egyptian courts were monitored by the bureaucrats. So, and you know, one thing that really struck me when I read it was, I mean, you know, I had sort of gone into this paper sort of assuming that, you know, it was, you know, there were Greeks who were first class citizens and Egyptians who were second class citizens, and that's not entirely wrong, but, you know, the one thing that really struck me about the last case was how rigorously the Chromanistae court applied Egyptian law, and I really thought that was important because it seems like if you're taking your sort of, I mean, if you take the implications of the, you know, of the bureaucratic increase in power, you know, you would think that they would, you know, that they would be in a position, well, that they would ignore Egyptian law when it didn't benefit, you know, themselves or one of their own. And it's true, like I say, and that they probably could have done it without any repercussions because they were pretty much their own masters, you know. But still, you know, they took a lot of time to reach, you know, I don't know, I mean, we don't know all the facts of the case, but, so, I mean, there could be things, that, you know, there could be documents that were lost and we don't know about, but, I mean, it seems like they went to a lot of effort to reach the right result, and I thought that was impressive just because, I mean, it showed that, I mean, I think that at the end of the day, it did show that the bureaucrats sort of understood understood very well the status quo of Ptolemaic society, and that was that, you know, like I said at the very end, the people, you know, provide revenue in exchange for justice. And I thought it was interesting it's really counterintuitive that you have power-hungry bureaucrats who go out of their way to reach just results. You know, I mean, it seems absurd to us, you know, but that does seem to be what happened, and to be honest, I don't know why, and I don't really think anybody does, except that maybe they were exceptionally far-sighted, and they just saw that if they took too many liberties, you know, they would end up with, you know, a huge revolt on their hands. And actually, well, it's remarked on in the paper just briefly, but there was a very large revolt in Ptolemaic Egypt and Central Egypt, actually in Thebes, where the Hermias trial occurred, so it could be that the sitting justices or whatever you want to call them, you know, were, you know, by virtue of where they were hearing the case, were you know, had that in mind. So, I mean, and then of course that's the other issue, is that the Hermias trial could be, for all we know, an isolated incident. You know, whereas in other cases they could have, you know, reached whatever result they wanted. You know, because, you know, I mean, especially in this case where some of the parties are Egyptians, you know, they can just decide everything in Greek, and, you know, the Egyptians will never know. So, and that's pretty much all I have. So, any questions? I'm open. I hope I know them. I know you're in.
Do we have any idea, we keep talking about their large tax revenues, do we have any idea what fraction of national income the state was collecting?
Well, see, that's like one of the distinctions that's made in some of the sources is between state revenue and royal revenue.
Take both of them for a moment. Do we know how
large of the whole economy?
That's correct.
Oh, now that's not a question I know the answer to, but, you know, see,
what does large mean? What's the standard of comparison?
Oh, well, compared to other, you know, Near Eastern societies, like, or even to the, actually, I think they're usually compared to pre-Ptolemaic revenues, and they're much larger, and that's partly because after the Ptolemies conquered Egypt, there was a large immigration of literate Greeks, and so that, you know, engendered some, I think, economic growth, although scholars these days are kind of split on whether or not there was large-scale economic growth over the course of the Ptolemaic period, but the general agreement is that there was growth at the beginning.
You said, I thought, that pre-Ptolemaic the taxes were in kind.
Yeah.
So how do we compare taxes in cash to taxes in kind? Do we actually know the volume of whatever was being produced and what it was worth?
Yeah, I mean, I think we do. I don't have that in the paper, and I don't...
I'm just curious.
Yeah, no.
It's easy to talk about somebody being rich, but after all...
Rich is only... Wealth is only relative.
There are, if you think of sort of particularly of kleptocratic black sub-Saharan African regimes... Mm-hmm. The rulers are very rich people. They've got, you know, $100 million in a Swiss bank account. They're very poor societies. And I'm just curious, if you look at this, whether we know more than that the Ptolemies were seen as rich by contemporaries.
Well, one thing I think we can say is that the people of Ptolemaic Egypt weren't any poorer than they were before, you know, except that
isn't that evidence that they were paying more taxes?
Well. See, I mean, I think that supports the economic growth theory. Is that, like, you know, whatever economic growth there was, that amount was sort of just, you know, swallowed wholesale by the government in fighting its wars. You know, so. But I'm not totally sure.
Other questions?
So, just to make sure I kind of have this right. So, Alexander.
So there's a couple of issues with that in there, but go ahead.
Okay, so Alexander comes in and conquers part of Egypt.
After Darius III was killed by his generals, Alexander was proclaimed the Persian emperor, you know, and king of Asia. So, I don't know if he ever actually entered Egypt.
Entered Egypt. The standard story is he entered Egypt and I believe had some kind of an interview with a god or a priest or something, which helps convince him that he's divine. I'm pretty sure that's part of the Alexander story.
I don't recall at all. But you know, the political issues would have been taken care of because basically he inherited Darius' domain. You know, he had gone with the intent to conquer it, but you know the fact that Darius was not a popular monarch, so, and apparently Alexander was fairly popular among the Achaemenid subjects, but I mean I think that was the source at least of you know Ptolemaic rule over Egypt. I don't know if there was. I'm not sure if it was conquest though. The way I have it in my head was that after. Alexander conquered Tyre. You know, he went east towards Babylon, Baghdad. So, yeah. But this is something I wanted to clear up. There's a typo in there, and it said that it implied that Alexander conquered Egypt from the native pharaohs. That's not true. It was the pharaohs controlled Egypt until about 525 BC when the Persians conquered Egypt, and then they ruled Egypt for about 200 years. Officially, but there was like a huge revolt that chucked out the Persians until a couple of years before Alexander showed up. So, you know, between putting down the revolt in Egypt and Alexander's conquest was a very short time. And then after that it was Alexander for like 10 or so years probably. And then it went to Ptolemy, who just took it as like, you know, his part of the empire basically.
And they were kind of central to Alexandria.
Yeah, Alexandria was the capital, and that was one of the cities founded by Alexander and settled with veterans, you know. So we have some projections for the Greek population of Egypt. You know, it's about 10%. But you know, one thing I was always interested in, but I couldn't find any sources for, was how much of Alexandria was Greek. And I figure at least in Alexandria there were probably a majority. A narrow one, possibly, I mean, in the city itself, you know, not the hinterland, but I think that seems at least more likely than not.
So you had something like a minority.
Oh, yeah, definitely. I mean, you know, Greeks talked out about 10% of the total population.
But besides, the Greeks didn't rule. The Ptolemies ruled.
Yeah. You know.
Right.
The Ptolemies ethnically Greek.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, well, were, that's an interesting question. They were Macedonian.
Yeah. And
the attitude of an Athenian would probably be no. They're barbarians. The attitude of a Macedonian would be yes.
I see.
And then there's the issue of whom they married, and I'm not sure. You know, I know some of the Ptolemies married, you know, native Egyptians, but I think a lot of them also married immigrant Greeks. You know, so it's, I mean, and I mean, you know, Like I say, ethnicity wasn't really that important. Initially, you know, they tried to segregate the courts based on ethnicity, but that was just too much trouble because people intermarried, you know. I mean, it wasn't, you know, there's one point that I didn't get to make in there because I couldn't really find a way to bring it in, but one of the points that was made pretty strongly in a couple of my sources was that, you know, was that Ptolemaic Egypt was not an apartheid system, you know, I mean, in no sense, except that, you know, there were, you know, distinct legal systems for different people. But like I say, you know, that was easily abused because after a pretty short time of struggling with determining, you know, who was what, they just decided to make it the language of the documents. And because they were bilingual scribes, you can get your documents in whatever language you wanted. So, you know. Even Hebrew, probably.
But this gets us back to one of my general puzzles about polylegal systems.
Mm-hmm.
It's fine if we're signing a contract mm-hmm. and we have choice of law and we can decide to have the contract done in Arabic or in Greek. This is an issue that arises with the different schools of Islamic law. But how about if I'm suing you? How about if it's not a consensual arrangement initially? So if I'm Greek and you're Egyptian and I'm suing you or you're suing me, what court does it go to? Do we know?
Well, there was initially a court that was an equitable court for disputes between Greeks and Egyptians, but I don't think it was around for a little while and then it sort of disappeared from the sources, you know. And I think that
and what law did it decide under?
I don't actually know. Like I said, it was pretty minor. I think that, you know, it just depends on the... I guess it would probably depend on both the document, the language of your documents and the court you brought it in. So, I mean, like, if you had a, you know, if you had a Greek court, probably, you know, and then one side submitted their documents in Greek, it'd probably be Greek, but I really don't know. But
wait a minute. We say their documents. I claim that you let your cattle stray into my wheat field and did a whole lot of damage.
Yes.
So there's no contract between us.
No. I mean, the documents you submit to the court to, you know, initiate the action.
But does that mean that the plaintiff automatically has to decide the court?
I actually don't know. I haven't read anything about that aspect.
It'd be worth at least trying to figure out, because that's the general one. The one unclear part about all of these polylegal systems is how they handle it. And I was wondering whether maybe your top-level court that you kept mentioning would handle all of that.
Well, now, see, that's the interesting thing, because the Hermias trial, the one at the very end, that is between a Greek and an Egyptian. And the Hermias Dei court, the high court, explicitly considered both Greek and Egyptian law. And basically, they decided that... as far as I can tell, what they decided was that, you know, Greek law informed their decision, I'm sure, but it was pretty clear from what I read that the court found that the Egyptian mortuary priests had a really strong argument based on Egyptian law, so they chose to apply Egyptian law based on, like, the strength of the argument, but I will try to find that out, but I just don't know.
Something else that struck me about it, sort of is interesting, not really a question, is that your account of the Ptolemies accepting Egyptian law in a way fits the account that Wael Halak, one of my main sources for the Islamic stuff, gives. As one of the questions about Islamic law is whether you really had separation of state and law. And part of Halak's argument is that you've got these Turkish princes ruling places in like Syria and Iraq. They don't much care what the law is. They want legitimacy. And therefore, they're willing to say to the legal experts, keep doing what you think is proper Islamic law. And you're really telling a very similar story here.
Oh, yeah, it's exactly the same thing, you know, because... although possibly more intense, because the Ptolemies explicitly wanted to be pharaohs, you know, both for the benefit of the native Egyptians and also for the immigrant Greeks, because, you know, the pharaoh was a god king, you know, so, I mean, that's powerful no matter who you are, you know, so, that would be actually interesting. I'm not sure, like, you know, because for Egyptians, you know, the pharaoh is supposed to be the son of Horus, you know. I'm not sure which, you know, Greek god the Ptolemies picked to be sons of for the Greeks. But, that was explicitly the goal of actually both the Persians and the Ptolemies. And one thing that I could never resolve, and this actually still kind of pisses me off, that I haven't found an answer for, is why it worked for the Ptolemies but not for the Persians. The Persians were despised by the Egyptians. And Ptolemies were, if not popular, then at least tolerated. You know, I mean, there were a couple of, you know, rebellions and such, but none like the one that, you know, destroyed Persian rule in Egypt. And I think the answer has to be that, you know, the Persians had that whole, like, you know, thousand nations thing going, and, you know, I think the Persian emperors, you know, they sort of, maybe they had a little bit of cultural posturing going where they said, you know, we are the Persian emperors and nothing else, you are our subjects, you know, whereas the Ptolemies tried to integrate themselves with the traditions, even though, you know, I mean, it seems like a huge difference for what amounts to a nominal change, because, you know, I mean, even more than the Ptolemies, the Persians just accepted pharaonic law, you know, but they just ruled with a different title, I think. You know, I mean, as far as I know, the Persian emperors never took the title of pharaoh, so that could be it. And, you know, I mean, it would make a certain amount of sense because of the nature of Maat, you know, because the king, you know, the pharaoh is the embodiment of Maat, you know, harmony, justice, in pharaonic.
Were the Persians ruling via viceroy?
Yes, satraps. I mean, it was divided into Persian satrapies, like the rest of their empire.
Because I think the one difference also is that the Ptolemy, Egypt really was what Ptolemy was ruling.
Yeah.
Whereas
part of the
Persian system was to have semi-independent local rulers.
And you know, it could have been pharaonic Egypt has an incredibly long history, you know, at least 5,000 years, you know, and it was, and, you know, the whole concept of Maat was so ingrained in the Egyptian society that it seems at least possible that the, you know, refusal to, you know, sort of respect those traditions in maybe a nominal form could have set them off. I mean, at least the intelligentsia, you know, whom Darius the first, not the third, had, you know, come together and recite the law, so to be codified.
Another question I was wondering about, partly in light of what we'll probably be talking about Thursday, is that Egypt was in some sense a hydraulic empire.
Oh, yeah, sure.
That is, that the control over water was very important. Mm-hmm. I was mentioning this because another related points were made about the Maya, who we're going to have a couple of papers on. And I was wondering how that affected any of it. That to what extent did the government sort of exist to allocate the Nile's water?
To a fairly large extent. It's referenced a little bit in the paper. Horaeus was a royal tenant from the Fayum, which was an area of major agricultural reclamation, you know, turning desert into farmland. And so, you know, it seems at least likely that the Ptolemies, you know, engaged in these reclamation actions in order both to, you know, increase revenue for themselves and to hand out favors, you know. So, you know, I mean, you call it sort of a, I mean, it's like a, what's the analogy I'm looking for? But, you know, they make more land available and they take it for themselves, you know.
Do we know how water was allocated?
I'm sure we do, but I haven't read about it. Yeah.
I mean, I'm just wondering if that it might have been that a noticeable part of their power comes to the fact that they're deciding who gets water for irrigation.
This is something I didn't mention there, but the Nile was incredibly important for a different reason beyond just the agricultural, but because it provided a really regular communications corridor that enabled central rule, you know, a long way away. So that was another thing. But I don't know how water was allocated. I'm sure it was part of the power, and it was, I mean, like, it was at least a threat they could use, you know, but, and that's possibly how they ended the Thebes revolt, which I mentioned, and, you know, because that's how Hermias came to have his claim against the Egyptian priests.
Well, another question from my list. You're talking, it sounds from what you're saying, as though you think that a lot of sort of ordinary law was happening below the radar of this legal system.
Yeah, quite a bit.
Do we know if there was a de facto feud system? Do we know if they had the view that if you would wrong me, I was entitled to do bad things to you?
You know, honestly, I've never seen any evidence of that, right. And that's because, and I think that's because of the ubiquity of temples, you know, because it's mentioned in there that in pharaonic Egypt, you know, the religious authorities were really key to dispute resolution, and I think that, as you know, because, you know, Egyptian religion is a huge, you know, was a huge edifice in the country, and pretty much everyone could be assumed to have some knowledge of a cleric or something like that. They had some form of authority they could petition to without having to resort to feud systems.
So if I have a claim against you and I don't want to go to the court, how do I make you pay attention to my claim?
Oh, well, there was a, that was I don't know about Ptolemaic, the Ptolemaic period, but during the Pharaonic period, they would just have representatives from the families negotiate, I think. And
why don't you just ignore me?
Well,
I want to, again, your cattle has strayed into my field. They've eaten my grain. I think you owe me some damages, and you say go away. Where do I get the leverage to make you negotiate?
I don't actually know, but I think I figure it must have been from local scribes and priests, that sort of thing was frowned on, because I've read a lot of sources and I haven't seen any indication of a feud system, which is why I didn't even mention it.
Doesn't have to be a feud system,
yeah.
But all things are something.
Do the priests
have the legal power to allocate land or to give punishments or anything?
I think so. I think they did. They had the temple oath, which I didn't really elaborate on there, and that was where both parties would sign a some kind of document, stating the state of their rights. And basically, I think that the way it worked, it was that when you died, if you'd violated that, it was a judge against your soul, your heart is weighed against a feather kind of thing, So, that's part of the threat, I think, is that the possibility of divine punishment.
Another question.
Okay.
You say early on that there's a complete law code divided into three titles. Does this law code survive?
I don't think so. I mean, it's attested to by citations, in a couple of places. And like I said, there's a letter mentioning it. But I haven't found.
If it survives, it ought to be in your article.
Yeah,
because you ought to have more information.
Yeah,
about it.
I don't think it does. I mean, I think it's mostly just.
You should find out because it's relevant.
I think
if there really is a code, it's one of the first things to look at.
Yeah.
I was also a little puzzled since you said that the transaction for selling involved two documents.
Yeah.
A sales document and a quitclaim.
Mm-hmm.
Why do you need the quitclaim? If the sales document says, I gave you money in exchange for this land, why do I need a second thing saying that you give me the land?
I think that was because of the whole title thing. The contract forms the basis of title.
Isn't the first part, why doesn't the purchase itself provide title? First document says I gave you 15 shekels of silver in exchange for.
So there were two documents. One was like acknowledgement of receipt of the purchase price. And the other one was a quick claim to the.
Does the first document say what the purchase price is for?
Yeah, but now see, it's actually I didn't put this in there because I didn't think it was a huge deal. But the two documents were often written on the same papyrus. On the back, they were legally distinct, but I don't think they ever had much practice.
But what does the second one add?
Oh, the second one is the first one I think just says that he bought this from me for X price. The second one says I relinquish all my rights in this thing to.
Part of what I'm getting at is I'm wondering whether the all my rights adds something, whether I might have bought it subject to your reserving some rights, or whether I might have made the payment for a 10-year rental, whether if you think in sort of the modern term of bundles of rights with regard to land, I'm wondering if the quit claim specified exactly what I had gotten.
Well, now that could actually play into the Hermias thing, because the implication is that the land, was unlawfully appropriated from the father, but then it was validly sold to the priests. And so I think that there's an indication there that you could reserve some rights, and maybe it's not a quit claim to all the rights, it's a quit claim to the rights you are transferring. So,
why doesn't that automatically follow from the fact that you've accepted payment for it?
Well, I suppose it does, but, the receipt of the payment wouldn't necessarily, detail all of the rights that you're giving up or the ones that you're reserving, so.
Does the quit claim list what the rights are?
I think so. I'm not totally sure about that. I'll look further into it.
You comment about how much of the population were bureaucrats. Do we actually, what kind of data are those statements based on? I should say, by the way, another general comment for everybody is that it is worth thinking about how reliable your data sources are. I was noticing this reading the Maya papers that sort of it's hard for me to tell reading them whether how much of what I'm reading in that case is. We are confident that these things are true, and how much these are the best guesses about something we don't know much about, or where in between them. So one of the things you want to certainly think about and say a little bit about, I think, in your papers is where is this information coming from?
Well, the information comes from the literacy rate. You know, there's an upper limit for the bureaucracy. You know,
Upper limit stated in what form?
Well, I mean, there's a consensus as to the literacy rate in Egypt. You know, about 7% before the conquest, and then some increase for the number of immigrant Greeks, and then obviously, you know, your bureaucrats can only, you don't have to be literate. So the literacy rate sets an upper level for the size of your bureaucracy. So I mean I haven't looked any further.
What
than that.
You know, what gives you the lower limit though?
No. Let's see. Hang on. If anything else, I'm here with it. Okay. Oh, and well, the other thing that I think indicates at least a large bureaucratic class is the fact that there were so many documents. You know, it's just that, I mean, it takes time to write all of these things. You know?
Yeah, but they had 300 years to do it in. So
it's true. Well, because a lot of the documents are preserved in the form of cartonnage for mummies, face masks, we can be pretty sure of their dates, you know. And so, like I say, you know, there's a huge amount of stuff.
How many documents per year were being written?
Oh, I don't know the exact numbers, but you know, it's one thing that I have read, you know, several times is that there's an absolutely huge number of documents dating from the reign of Ptolemy the Second Philadelphus, which is why he kind of looms large in a lot of these analyses. And but you know, he didn't rule. I don't think he ruled that long. I think he ruled for like 15 years, maybe. You know, so I mean, you can get a sense of it based on that, and I'll put that in the final. But I haven't read any firm data about
so that when people talk about this is huge or this is wealthy, it's nice if you can somehow
do some comparison. Yeah.
Get. Right, now, do people have questions for him before we go on to hear about the Bedouins, which was one of the papers I enjoyed?
Were there any overt things that didn't kind of take on the Egyptian character, or the Egyptian way of life?
Oh,
like, kind of like
other than marrying their sisters.
Yeah, they did that. Well, no, I mean, you know,
the government to kind of show like any like overt acts other than maybe.
Well, actually, I'm pretty sure Ptolemaic dress was Egyptian. You know, the bureaucrats would have been attired much in the way they had been before. So, and you know, it wasn't. You know, I mean, the Ptolemies maintained their, you know, their sort of linguistic distinctiveness. You know, they kept. You know, they didn't really learn Demotic, but you know, they did take a lot of. You know, I mean, they appropriated a ton of the pomp and circumstance. You know, because that was. You know, I mean, that was good for manufacturing and legitimacy. So, I mean, that's certainly one thing they did. But the bureaucrats, I don't know. I'm sure that in Alexandria, you know, people probably walked around in togas and such. But
do we know what the Ptolemies dressed?
Well, for official functions, they wore Egyptian dress, I believe. And you know, their sarcophagi are virtually indistinguishable from pre-Ptolemaic sarcophagi, except that the faces are much more realistic. You know, like in the marble statues and stuff like that. So you know, there's a lot more realism in the art, but it's still got the same sort of, you know, flourishes with the, you know, the pyramidal beards and the headdresses and such. So you know, I'm fairly confident that at least in public settings, they dress as Egyptians. What they did in private, I think it probably be Greek, because you know, like I say, you know, the Ptolemies took great. I mean, you know, it's again an issue of, you know, sleeping on your rights. If you don't maintain your Greekness, how can you claim to be Alexander? You know, I mean, and especially because, like you said, you know, the Macedonians, and seeming Greek was huge for Macedonians because they were acutely aware of how they had been barbarians, and you know, even they feel like they've just barely gotten, you know, pulled themselves out of that particular hole. The rest of the, you know, Greeks are not convinced, but you know,
yeah. Other questions for? All right, thank you. Mm-hmm. I like this paper, by the way, partly because it fit in interesting ways with sort of similarities to the Somalis and such.
Yeah, I noticed that while I was researching it. So, it's about Bedouin law. I figured I'd just start by talking about some of my sources. So, one of the problems researching this is that you can't really talk about the Bedouin in general. You've got tribes all across the Middle East, and some of them are quite different from each other. But basically, the best study of the tribes are the ones that live in Sinai and up into southern Israel. And we've basically got a complete picture of their legal system and got a lot of stuff from Egypt as well. Like the Bedouin who live west of the Nile in Egypt are pretty much completely separate from those who live over in Sinai in Egypt. And so we've got a pretty complete picture of both of them. Then the other sources I looked at were typically looking at just very specific aspects of Bedouin law, like the trial by ordeal or the raising the flag thing in Yemen to call someone's honor into question. So there's basically sort of trying to piece together a broader picture of Bedouin law out of these sources. Anyone has any questions? Ask otherwise, just highlight some of the things.
One of the questions I wondered about was the availability of pre-modern sources. I emailed you about that a little bit because I have one story which touches on that, which is from pre-Islamic even. But that in general, sort of the one of the things I found a little bit odd about your paper was that it sounded as though the Bedouins had been in contact with non-Bedouin civilization only recently, whereas I would have said that they've been in contact with non-Bedouin civilization forever, more or less, and in particular, that once you have Muhammad, he is in effect incorporating them into the lands of peace, into the Muslim-ruled area, and my impression in Muslim history is that the Bedouins are around all the time. That, you know, the caliphs, I think the Umayyad caliphs, I think, had the custom of sending their children to grow up for a while with the Bedouins so they would learn pure Arabic, and that there are sort of, so have you tried to see, to look for sort of the Islamic literature to see whether they give us additional information about the Bedouin legal system?
I haven't looked at that specifically yet. One of the sources talks about it sort of in passing. She talks about how some terminology in the Bedouin dialect of Arabic still retains its pre-Islamic connotations.
Yeah.
Like the word sunnah, instead of referring to the traditions of Muhammad, it just means customary law in general.
Yeah. There is surviving pre-Islamic literature. There are the so-called suspended verses, which were a collection of several famous poems that were supposedly hanging, I think, in the Kaaba in Mecca before Muhammad. And there's other stuff. I've seen some bits of that, so which is quite interesting, and might help. I don't know, but if it was sort of, this is a ancient system, and you're looking at what's easiest to see, which is what's around now. But there's more there.
I think the Bedouin, they've been in contact with other societies for a long time. Like with the Ottoman Empire in Syria, basically your Bedouin sheikhs were acting as intermediaries between the Ottoman Empire and the local tribes. But I think more recently it's a question of states being able to impose their laws on the Bedouin.
Cassini, you were writing about the concept of the women, that it's not changing. So when there is, for example, can a father then decide that his daughter is getting divorced?
I'm not sure how divorce works.
I thought what you said was that when the tribe was moving somewhere away from her birth family, that sometimes the marriage would terminate because her father couldn't protect her. And you may or may not remember from the story that I sent you. In fact, probably isn't it, because I was giving you a short version. This class the story of how the long feud was ended between the brother tribes of Abs and Dubyan? I may have told that in class, I don't remember, but it's a pre-Islamic story, and one bit of it is is a woman's father says, so-and-so has come looking for a wife, what do you think? And she says, I'm not good looking, I got a bad temper, and he lives far from my father, and so need not fear him, and so I fear that I will come to the fate of a divorced woman. So she doesn't want to do the marriage. I haven't told you the story. If we run out of time, I'll tell you the story. It's a great story. Anyway, but one of the other things that sort of intrigued me, again, in the connection with a couple of things in the connection with the Somali, was that your original presentation, it sounds as though your various groupings are straight agnatic kinship. But then there are a couple of exceptions, because you mentioned the case where somebody gets another tribe to defend him, and then somebody, then he joins that, I don't know, his tribe or commune, but at some level. So it sounds as though, and you're also mentioning that there are cases in which the kinship group says it won't protect a particular person, at least against particular offenses. So both of those sound as though it's agnatic kinship tempered by contract, which is what the Somali system really is, and that sort of was neat, if I understood it correctly.
When I thought about that more after getting your comments, that these tribes, this goes back farther than just the five generations for Akamsa, but practically every tribe, you know, claims to be descended from some legendary figure or something, and so, you know, these lineages are not necessarily set in stone.
That's part of what's intriguing me about all of this, is that Somali and Bedouin speak different languages. They are both at least nominally Muslim. They have rather similar patterns of life, though not identical. And they have a whole bunch of similarities, and I'm wondering whether we're observing parallel development or influence. And then I noticed that some of the similarity carries across to the Irish. Mm-hmm. Well, that's not influence. That's got to be parallel development, I think. I mean, the neither the Somali nor the Arabs are Indo-European. So if there's any cultural link, it's way, way back.
Since they were nomadic, could some of the, I guess, parallel development be attributed to
there clearly is influence in the Somali tradition. The Somali famous ancestor of the tribe is sometimes Arab. That is to say, the Somali traditions pretty clearly imply that you've got occasional Arabs who are coming into Somalia and merging into that society. So there certainly is possible influence. I mean, Somalia, if you look at the map, it's just across a not very wide body of water from Arabia. And therefore there's clearly interaction back and forth. If you look at the sort of the early Islamic stuff, Muhammad at one point sends some of his followers in the very early period who are under pressure from the Meccans off to Ethiopia, Abyssinia, whatever they're calling it, which is the next door neighbor to Somalia, basically, where they interact with the ruler, the Christian ruler of that area. So that whole part of the world. And I think there's a point pre-Muhammad, there's a little while when there is a Abyssinian empire that includes parts of Arabia. I think that's right, and then gives it up later. So there certainly is interaction, but at the same time, these are pretty strong connections. Other people's comments, questions? I was wondering what feel you have for what gives symbolic acts power. That is, you have wronged me. You refuse to make it good. And for whatever reason, I can't use the mechanisms of feud to do you, so I put up a banner saying you've wronged me. Why do you care?
Because then I suppose everybody else can see that banner. They're going to know that, I suppose, whether or not it's, you know, true or justified what I did, but they're going to know that you're involved in some sort of dispute they might not want to have anything to do with you.
No. With regard to the Irish, you'll notice that there's a parallelism there, too, because of the sureties. You didn't call them that. You called them guarantors, I think. The Irish system, the two basic kinds of surety are the Natum surety and the Roth surety. And the Roth surety seems to correspond to what you're describing, because he's the person who agrees that if you don't pay your debt, I'll pay it. Am I right in thinking that that's what your Bedouin guarantors are doing?
There's That would be one type.
What else do they do?
There's a guarantor who guarantees that the defendant will show up.
How is he entitled to make that good guarantee? What kind of a guarantee is that? In the Irish case, I think we know. And I think he's not obligated to pay the debt if the guy doesn't show up. What he has is the legal power to use force to make the person show up. That's the native surety. And I'm just wondering if that's happening here or not, or if we can tell.
I think what happens is once someone agrees to become your guarantor, then if the defendant doesn't show up at the trial, the guarantor then can go after him as an additional claim against.
And does the guarantor have the right to sort of beat him up and drag him into court?
I don't know.
Which what sounds, I think that was happening in the Irish case, if I read it correctly, that's a legal assault, as it were, and that's why I'm curious about the...
Yeah, I'm not sure.
We don't know.
Physically.
Well, if you can find somehow, it would be fun. Something else that intrigued me, one of the reasons that I plan to email Peter Leeson to tell him to look at your paper, is the ordeal stuff. Because Peter's got a paper, aside from his pirate stuff, on medieval ordeals, which is not that, his view is not that different from some of the views you sketch about it, that the ordeal is being basically rigged by people who have their own opinion about who's guilty and who's innocent, which I thought was sort of neat.
Of course, part of the problem with rigging the ordeal is whether the person administering it just holds out the hot metal and then the defendant leans forward and licks it, or whether the administrator actually sticks it on the guy's tongue.
Yes. But if you try to think, if you try to actually imagine acting it out, if I'm holding it and you're licking it, I may still be able to control how long it's in contact with you. You know, I can twitch it away very quickly or push it towards you as you lick it or whatever.
One of the sources was very adamant that that does not happen. The way he described it is the administrator holds the metal out like this across his body.
Uh-huh. So that's interesting, yeah. But he can also control how hot it is,
yeah,
which might also affect him. Anyway, all of that struck me as intriguing. Intriguing stuff. Other questions from other people?
Yeah. Sure. You said that present governments could pretty much tolerate, socially the Bedouins, but as far as the actual government policies, a lot of times they actually deprive them of their property rights. For example, like you were saying in Syria, do you think that they tolerate them because really it's almost impossible to enforce the kind of property rights? I mean, it seems that they're way out there, and the cost of properly enforcing would be...
Yeah, I think that's a big part of it. Like, what happened in Syria was the government confiscated all their land, decided to use it for new agricultural purposes, and it basically destroyed the steppe, just messed up the ecosystem there, and then they figured, if we want to fix this, we may just have to kind of let the Bedouin do what they were doing before.
Heather? Thank you very much. Fun paper. Can we now hear about Russia? There you are, hiding behind the lady in between us.
So my paper is about medieval Russian law, and basically it all started with Yaroslav the Wise in the 11th century. He wrote down, he had a codified law, which is called the Pravda, and Pravda translates into truth, order, and it was about 26 rules, and they addressed most of the stuff that we view today as crime, like murder, theft, and so on and so forth. Basically, what happened is throughout between the 11th century and the 15th century, the code kind of expanded. They added new rules, new laws. And what started happening is there was a transition from a purely horizontal system where people were basically administering their own justice. So if someone aggrieved you, it was basically a pure tort where you go to that person and you look for some sort of satisfaction or payment. And as time went on, the prince started having more of the, became more of an authority figure and started administering more of the laws and the punishments and so on and so forth. And so I'll start with one of the first ones, murder. They dealt with murder in a kind of a unique way. The first one was before the code passed, they did, the only remedy was blood revenge. So if someone aggrieved you, murdered someone in your family, you can take, you know, your cousins, whatever, and go kill that person, and that's a wash. Technically, that should be how you get arrested, or how you deal with those type of matters. However, with the first codified law, they wanted to kind of move away from that system because it's not really sustainable, you know, it enforces murder, and the types of people do that. And so they started passing this thing called, just like in, what was it, the Icelandic, the system of Vergo, where basically, instead of me going and, you know, seeking blood revenge, I can go up to you and say, pay me this certain amount of money, and in Russia it was 40 hryvnia, whatever their currency is, and that's a wash, and that should have settled that. And so, basically, they didn't move away completely from the blood revenge system, but they implemented that werguild system as well. So I'm assuming they took it from the Norse, or sorry, the, what was it again? The Icelandic. Yeah, they took it from the Icelandic. I'm assuming.
Well, sort of Icelandic happens to be one we've got well recorded, but the people who they were getting it from were probably Swedes, since I think that's who the Rus actually were. That it's the same culture, roughly.
So basically, yeah, the assumption is that they got it from the Northerners, from their system, because, you know, they're right next to it. And so, the second, oh, so there's also this concept where if there was a murder and you don't know who it is, and the person doesn't come forth, then the community within this, where the murder occurred had to pay the family of the murdered person. So the community would pay the 40 to that family, and again, that should be a wash. However, if the person comes back, then you would have to pay the community back and the person as well, so it's almost like a double whammy. So, you know, it wasn't good to do that. However, so once, as I mentioned before, the system's kind of moved away from like the pure court system where you pay directly to the person, you pay for more for the, you pay for the prince, so it's kind of a form of more of a criminal form, system where the prince implements the punishment, you pay him the fine. And again, this is kind of an unclear part of it. It seems like you would pay a certain fine to the prince and then a certain fine to the family as well. So the 40 would be split between the prince and the family. Let's see, what else? So that pretty much is what... Oh, there was also this distinction where if you kill a princely figure, it's like a princely servant, I don't know, whatever those people were, you would pay 80. So instead of 40, it's double the fine. And the assumption was that, A, you know, it's an important figure, but also the assumption was that you kill a princely figure, the prince loses a value in that person because he is their servant, and also the family of the prince, of that servant, gets a certain remedy as well because, well, they lost someone close to them. And that also kind of implies that the prince was starting to get more and more power within the community because he was able to implement those higher fines for his own people. There's also this distinction that if someone goes to your house and steals something and you catch them, right, you are allowed to kill that person. However, if you capture that person and you hold, you tie them up, hold them down until morning, you can no longer kill that person. You have to submit him to the prince's justice. And basically, I guess the assumption was that, you know, once the person's captured, there's really no reason for your murder, whereas if it's in the heat of the moment, then you can go ahead and do it.
That's the Chinese law also.
Yeah. Okay, so there you go. And where was I going with that? Oh, and also, if you kill the person, now, even if you capture him and you decide that you want to kill him that next morning, you pay a fine, but you don't pay the 40, you pay a reduced fine of 12. So I guess they still kind of didn't want to make it more okay for you to kill someone.
In general, how close is it to a fixed fine for everybody? You're saying that it's a larger fine for the prince's servants.
Right.
It's a lower fine for a captured thief.
Right.
What about a woman?
It was 20, so it's half.
Half for a woman.
So yeah, they pretty much on the code, they set prices for virtually everything. So you kill a slave, it's like 5. You kill a farmer, it's like 10. You kill a slave, it's, you know, whatever, 5. If you kill a slave woman, it's 6 for some reason. So I guess slave, female slaves are valued more. There's also this, yeah, so that's basically, let's see if I wrote that down. So that pretty much takes care of that. So murder was basically, to summarize that, was that you have blood revenge as your primary remedy, which you were still allowed to do. Or in the alternative, you could have asked for compensation. And then as time went on, that compensation system started getting paid some to the prince and some to the family as well. The next thing is assault. So again, just like before, it was kind of a pure tort system. You assault somebody, you hurt them, you're supposed to pay money. There's also particular fines for certain assaults. So if you hit someone...
If you assault somebody and don't pay money in the original system, is he entitled to kill you in revenge or to assault you in revenge?
There was revenge, so I guess you could fight him back or beat him. So that
but,
was
you,
still,
but do you know if that if you kill someone, his kin can kill you?
Right.
And then the compensation is a way out of that. If you do a wrong short of killing him, is there then a limit to what they can do to you, or can they still kill you if you don't compensate?
See, the code isn't really clear on that. The code basically says that if someone assaults you, you are allowed to seek revenge on that person. I'm guessing revenge, based on like how the system worked, is that the revenge needs to be equitable to what they caused to you. So yeah. It kind of needs to be a wash. So if you're killing them, I'm assuming the other family is now allowed to kill you. So it's, again, it's a balancing thing, balancing act, so you don't want to do more.
But you can't actually tell from the text.
Exactly. It's not entirely clear. This is, you know, 1,000 years ago. So, but the code does say something along the lines of you're allowed to seek revenge. Now, they added fines to that aspect as well, so I'll read some stuff to you. So if you unsheath a sword without striking, it's a 1 grievance fine. If you strike someone with a weapon, it's 3. If you assault with something like a rod, a club, or sword, it's 12. If you take someone's limb off, it's also 12. If you knock someone's, you hit someone's face and damage it, it's 1 grievance for every teeth that's knocked out. And then, oddly enough, if you cut someone's limb off, it's 20. And if, there was one weird one where it's, okay, so if you cut someone's mustache or beard, it's 12. So it's like 4 times what it would cost to, like, you know, cut someone's or horn. Yeah, it's 4 times what it would cost to assault someone, pretty much what it would cost to, you know, kill a female. And the assumption is that back in the day it was a symbol of status to have a beard or a mustache. And so if you cut someone off, it's, you're degrading them in front of society. So that was frowned upon. And then, another thing was theft. This is kind of a weird thing where they don't really explain it. I didn't find a lot of scholars that could really explain this process in detail, but the idea is if someone steals your stuff, you can't go up to them and say, hey, you stole my stuff, give it to me. You have to say, hey, that's my stuff, can you help me find who took it? And that person is supposed to help tell you where they got it from and help you go to that person. And you go down that line of purchasers until you ideally eventually find the person who actually stole it. However, that it seems kind of wishy-washy. I mean, no one's going to want to help you. If someone has your stuff, it just seems like it wasn't really how it is, but I couldn't find anywhere that...
But isn't it possible that what's going on is that if he doesn't tell you, he's presumed to be the thief?
He is, but again, that's kind of like, what are you supposed to do about it? Steal it back? You're not supposed to steal it back under the code. You're supposed to... They didn't give you a remedy in case...
But what do you... When you finally get to the thief, what are you supposed to do?
You're supposed to pay you a fine, for stealing, and you get the property back.
So how about if the first person you go to says, I won't tell you who I got it from, you say, that must mean you're the thief, and then try to proceed, and however you proceed against the thief, is that a possible?
It is a possible thing, but again, it's not really clear, because you would say, hey, give me money, he goes, no. What are you supposed to do at that point?
What do you do if it's the thief, and he says no?
Either
it sounds as though the answer is almost got to be either it's a privately enforced system, and if he says no, you kill him, or it's a prince enforced system, and if he says no, you report to the agents of the prince, and the prince uses force to make him pay.
I think that's the thing, that in the beginning it was a purely private system, so you're supposed to execute your own justice. You're supposed to go to that person and say, hey, give me my stuff. Well, you can't say give me my stuff, but you're supposed to get your stuff back through a mean, through a private mean. As time went on, they made it more of an autocratic system where the prince was administering the justice. But again, that isn't really clear on how they actually managed to prove who took it and then get the fine from him and then give the property. So basically that system that I just described is called conferment. It's where they help each other find the thief. But the actual execution and making the person pay the fine, I mean, that's kind of...
How clear a picture do we have of the royal enforcement authority? These princes, is this the prince of one city-state, or is this the prince of a sizable chunk of Russia, or what?
So there's the big major cities, Novgorod, Kyiv, Moscow, and they each have their own princely figures, and they are basically the ones that administer the justice.
And how wide is the area that the prince of Kiev is actually ruling?
The area of Kyiv. I mean, it's,
that's the name of the city.
Right.
How about for 100?
Asking if it's like the outskirts of it.
Outskirts. If you're halfway between Kiev and Moscow, who's your ruler?
That's not clear. I can answer that because I'm not really sure.
Because that's what I'm asking.
I'm guessing. Well, my guess is that at that point, I mean, how would the prince even reach that area? I mean,
I understand. That's part of what I'm wondering is, if the prince is somehow involved in rights enforcement, does that mean that there's some kind of a bureaucracy and subordinates or a feudal system or something? And when you say he's the prince of Kiev, does that mean he's the prince of the town of Kiev and everything between Kiev and Moscow is ruled by nobody? Or does it mean that he's really the prince of a principality whose capital is Kiev, but which extends for 100 miles in every direction? I don't know.
My understanding is that there's these cities, right? They're big cities. They're pretty far apart, and they have their own princely figures. Each prince administers their own justice. Each prince usually took on a different sort of form of pravda and made their own codified rules. And as far as the outskirts and those areas where it's not entirely clear, my guess is that there's nothing they could have done. I mean, how could they? So
you think it may be that stuff that wasn't close to a major city, there really was no royal rule?
There's no royal rule, but there's still that idea. I'm assuming most of them were familiar with the laws, right? So if there's a codified law that some people have listened to, then that kind of spreads around. So that system of private enforcement probably played a role over there. However, I'm not sure. I'm not even sure how to find that out, but...
Because one of the issues that, as I mentioned to you earlier, this sort of raises is you wrong me, and the law says that you owe a sizable payment to me and a sizable payment to the prince. If the enforcement is all by me, why don't you and I cut out the prince? Why don't I go to you and say, look, if we go through all of this stuff, you're going to owe me 40 hryvnia and the prince 40 hryvnia. How about you just pay me 40 hryvnia and I'll forget about it? And if, in order to prevent that, you somehow need some mechanism in which the prince has got people who are responsible for enforcing his claim.
I think you're a little incorrect in the sense that you think that 40 will be paid to him and 40 will be...
Whatever the amount is, doesn't matter.
The fee was usually set at a certain amount. The way it was split between the prince and the person was different. So in your scenario, you would say, I'll just give you 40 and we're good. How is that better than the prince coming in, taking the 40, giving 20 to the family, and taking 20 to himself?
Oh, but I'm going to offer you a better deal than that. If the prince gives me only 20, right, you'll give me 30, and I'm 10 better off, and you're 10 better off, and the prince is 20 better off. Isn't that a great deal?
It sounds like an awesome deal. I think that where that fails is that if you're looking at an area where it's a city, and I think there's more of an established police force or something along those lines, and the community knows who committed a certain crime and they're aware of that person, then a prince can come in and administer the justice and say, you owe this money. You can't make a deal out of it.
But that's what we're trying to figure out.
Right.
In what sense what you have is really a privately decentralized feud system with the prince demanding a cut, and to what extent you have is something much more like what we think of as a modern law enforcement system. And since both of them exist historically in lots of different places and times, it's intriguing to see if you... One of the suggestions that I was making to him earlier, we were talking during my office hours, is see if you can find non-legal literature. That there is stuff that was written down at this time, which is stories, basically. Well, some of those stories, as in the sagas, the stories are largely law cases. So maybe some of the Russian stuff, you can actually see what's happening. And that's, again, something for all of you, really, that one of the places to look for information on a culture, aside from stuff that's explicitly legal, is primary source from that time and place from which you can see the legal system working. Right? I mean, noticeable chunks of Njal Saga happen in the legal dispute happening at the Althing. And, you know, and I admit Perry Mason is not a very reliable source of the American legal system, but if you imagine that you were studying the American legal system from 1,000 years away, it might be a lot better than nothing. That's right. You have no idea what a defense counsel is or what a plaintiff is or what a prosecutor is or that there are rules of evidence or any of that stuff, and you'd get a good deal of that, even if you'd come up with a rather odd idea of how the cases usually went. Yeah, continue.
And so as far as what we just talked about, the collecting fees, there were some statutes that addressed that particular aspect. So there was a fee, a tax collector. Now, there were some inconsistencies with the old code and the new code because, like I said, it was rewritten and they added, you know, a bunch of new statutes. The basic idea is that the prince sends a tax collector. How they decide who owes what is not really clear. Again, I'm assuming it's kind of like those things where the community knows that this guy committed murder. Now, the tax collector goes up to that person and says, pay me the money. The fee under the code is split in the following manner. The prince gets about 80% of the proceeds, the church gets 17%, and the sheriff, again, I'm not really sure what that is, about 1 or 2%. So that's how the fee was split. Now, when the tax...
This is all from the prince's share as opposed to the victim's share, right?
Right, and that's another thing that's kind of unclear is that, well, where... What money goes to the actual aggrieved party if you're splitting it that way? So that's one of the things I address because they don't really talk about that. So it's kind of one of those inconsistencies where you do have this system of where you're trying to compensate the aggrieved party, but you also have this system where you're paying the prince and now you're also adding the church and the sheriff. And the fee splitting is kind of unclear, basically. And one other thing about the tax collector is that the people of the area where the tax collector is have to supply them with food, shelter, housing, and all that stuff. So it's up to the people to go ahead and support this tax collector, who's basically coming to take their money away. And as far as how that worked, if it worked in practice, I don't know, but that's what the code implies that they were supposed to do. And the last part was slavery. Now, slaves are kind of, just like in most societies, are just viewed as property. You're not really giving them a whole lot of power as far as what they can do or cannot do. One of the basic principles is that the slave owner is completely liable for the acts of a slave. So any of the crimes that were committed by a free person, if they're committed by a slave, the owner would have to pay for that slave in virtually the same manner that if he was to commit those crimes. There's also this idea where, if you remember what I said before about society kind of having to, in cases of murder, that society would, the community would have to pay the murder's fine if they don't disclose who it is. So basically, if you think about it, it kind of gives the community an incentive to go ahead and basically say who the murderer is so they don't have to pay for it. The same idea kind of holds true with slavery, because if you help a slave escape, you owe, I think it's like 10 hryvnia to the person whose slave ran away. If you capture the slave, then I think that you get paid a hryvnia. by the person who owned the slave. However, if you capture the slave and the slave runs away, you still pay the slave owner 12. So it's like as if you didn't even capture the slave. And so basically what I'm trying to get at is that the same concepts hold true. The monetary compensation with slave, if he commits a crime, you pay for it. The community is encouraged to help capture slaves by placing a fine on them if they help them, or if they capture them, then release them. And so, all in all, well, that pretty much that's it for slaves. So, in conclusion, what you're seeing with Russian law is this concept of going from a pure tort system where people administer their own justice with each other without any involvement with a prince or authority figure. So basically this movement where the authority figure, i.e. the prince, starts to implement fees on the people and kind of making it more of like a semi-criminal law system. And
part of what we don't know is to what extent the prince was also enforcing the law.
Right. We don't know. I don't know a lot, basically. I'll be honest. So, I mean, I have the code. I have some books that I read. But basically, there's a lot of holes that I'm trying to fill in, but I mean, it's hard.
People think about it between now and Thursday, and you can come briefly up again if they have any more questions for you, and then we'll go on to, I think, the mire, what we're doing next. So a long distance from Russia to Central America. Thank you.